Hicks.
Thank you, Your Honor. George Hicks for Appellant Albert West. May it please the Court. Albert West's constitutional right to a speedy trial was violated when the state of Wisconsin did not bring him to trial until 14 months after filing a complaint against him for a single charge arising from a single purported incident involving a single alleged victim. During that exceedingly lengthy period for such an exceedingly straightforward charge, Mr. West asserted his right to a speedy trial, but it was ignored. The state, moreover, has never offered a valid reason for the lengthy delay. Indeed, it did not even notify Mr. West of the charge against him for nearly 5 months, despite the fact that during that time, Mr. West was sitting in a Wisconsin state prison.
So even if we gave you, though, the first three Barker factors, and the state is certainly to be blamed for not paying attention to where Mr. West was, Mr. Robinson is killed only 6 months into this time period. And it's hard for me to see how we could say there was prejudice to Mr. West from this delay, which is only a couple of months longer than what Barker would have tolerated. So nobody's saying this is ideal, but I don't see how the running of the extra time after the six-month period when Damian Robinson is killed prejudiced him.
Well, I think there's a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, the Supreme Court has never articulated any sort of nexus requirements between the length of delay and the specific prejudice. The test that they've articulated is that the length of delay is the first triggering factor, and then after that, the prejudice is a separate and independent factor. And I think that's borne out by the fact that in its brief, the state was not able to cite any case for that proposition with the exception of a New Mexico state case. And in that case, the prejudice was, I believe, destruction of evidence. It was not something that the Supreme Court has specifically identified as obvious prejudice, which is the death of an alibi witness, which is what we have here.
Which had already happened, you know, before much. In other words, if he'd been brought to trial in January of 2006, I don't think he would have a claim. Mr. Robinson would still have been dead. So that's part of what I'm thinking. The other thing is, if you look at these interests under prejudice to prevent oppressive pretrial incarceration, minimize anxiety and concern, limit the possibility that the defense will be impaired, it's only the third of those. He was already incarcerated anyway on other points and doesn't seem to have been terribly anxious or concerned about anything. It really boils down to Robinson, doesn't it?
Well, I think that to speak to you, the premise you were stating, I think that he did articulate anxiety, you know, and obviously, yes, it does occur in all cases in which there is a possible sentence, but the possible sentence for this particular crime was a 40-year sentence, and this is a situation where he had not even been notified of that charge until 5 months into the filing of the criminal complaint. But as to the third point about it prejudicing his actual defense, I think it's also very worthwhile to note that this point about Mr. Robinson, the time of Mr. Robinson's death, was not something that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals even brought up in its summary affirmance of the no merit report. And the district court, in addition, only noted it in a footnote. What both of those opinions pressed more on was the idea that, well, even if Mr. Robinson had been there, there's just absolutely no way that it could have had any effect on the jury's consideration. And I just don't think that that's borne out by the record evidence. And the state, in fact, in its brief, does not even raise the primary point on which the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, incorporating wholesale the no merit report, relied on, which is the testimony of Kelly O'Loughlin, which the state court of appeals, again incorporating the no merit report, had believed was damaging and devastating to Mr. West's defense. And the plain fact of the matter is that it actually, if anything, helped his defense, because it's an indication that all along Mr. West has had this concern about this missing witness. This is not something that came up at the 11th hour It's something that he had had all along. He happened to mention it to his colleague, Ms. O'Loughlin.
Well, either the missing witness or where was he? I mean, you know, she admits that she lies about where he was, and you've got all these other witnesses who do place him at the fair, right?
Well, that is true, but 2 points in response to that. Number one, the fact that she lied about the fact that Mr. West was with her at the casino is really no import to what Mr. West said. The record shows very carefully that Mr. West did not ask her to lie or instruct her to lie to the police about his whereabouts. The record simply says that he had told her that his alibi witness had died, and that is perfectly consistent with the idea that there was somebody out there who had died. And the second point about the other witnesses, all of these other witnesses, all of whom had multiple criminal convictions, were all very close friends or relatives of the alleged victim. And, you know, maybe in the abstract, well, you can say, well, that's just how witnesses are, but there's also record evidence in the testimony of Ms. O'Loughlin that the alleged victim and her friends were waiting outside the courtroom harassing her because they thought that she was going to testify against the alleged victim. So this is, I don't think this is a situation where we're just talking about disinterested third parties who happen to see them.
I'm not sure what you mean when you say that West had this concern about the missing witness all along. He didn't even tell his counsel about the person until they'd been dead for some period of time, right?
But the record does not actually show whether or when he told his counsel about that. That's just a presumption that is being drawn from the record, because the second assertion of the violation of the right to a speedy trial was not until September of 2006. However,
in that assertion, there was no indication that my delay is prejudicial or this delay is prejudicial because I've already lost a witness.
In the September 2006, yes, there was. There was a specific reference to Mr. Damian Robinson, who Mr. West was with on that night. And again, this is also consistent with two other points in the record. Number one, Mr. West's very first assertion, which was pro se, immediately after he even learned of the charge that his speedy trial right had been violated and he was no longer able to find his witnesses. And then second,
that's the October 05?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that is something that the State Court of Appeals does not touch on at all, even though it's articulated in Supreme Court authority. The force of his assertion, the coterminous with finding out that he had a charge against him and had a charge for nearly 5 months, he immediately asserted his right to a speedy trial. And the second point, Your Honor, about consistency with the idea of there being an alibi witness who had died, is the fact that he had told Ms. O'Loughlin, who was a colleague of his, that his alibi witness had died. So we have 3 points in the record at 3 different times where Mr. West has said that he has an alibi witness, that alibi witness died, and the Supreme Court and this court has emphasized critically the importance of a missing alibi witness when it comes to the speedy trial factors. And I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, representing the respondents Simden and Duffy. Two principles figure prominently in this appeal. One, the right at issue, the Sixth Amendment guarantee to a speedy trial, is, in the words of the United States Supreme Court, a right that is slippery, amorphous, and more vague than other procedural rights.
That makes it sound so awful, Ms. Miller.
The choice of words does sound a little bit unfortunate, but
it's just serious, right? You would, you know. So here's Mr. Robinson dead. You know, we may not think he was the world's greatest witness, but time does cast a certain price on our proceedings.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think Your Honor made an excellent point, though. The fact that Mr. Robinson died should not be factored into the prejudice prong of the four-factor Barker versus Wingo test, because his death occurred 6 months after the complaint was filed against Mr. West in June of 2005. He died 6 months later. At that point, the Barker versus Wingo inquiry would not even be triggered. Under Doggett, the United States Supreme Court has indicated that the point at which you even engage in the balancing test begins at about the one-year mark.
But surely at that point, you are looking at all the facts and circumstances, and the fact that a year has gone by and maybe a witness died partway through that year is at least a piece of evidence. It may not be enough to carry the day by itself, but I have never seen these cases as just blinding oneself to everything that happened during the first year.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. I don't have a specific United States Supreme Court case that says this, but I think by logical extension, if you accept Mr. Hicks's argument, you could have a witness who died a week after a complaint was filed, or you could have evidence that police inadvertently destroyed, say, a month after a complaint was filed, and that would later on be held against the state in a Barker versus Wingo inquiry, even though there is absolutely no nexus, no causal relationship whatsoever between the prejudice and the inordinate delay. And I think that makes no sense. I think common sense dictates that you should not be able to count that type of prejudice under the fourth factor. And even if you did, however, I think in this case, it's inaccurate to say, as Mr. Hicks has said, that all along West was concerned about the absence of Damian Robinson. I think the record does show, and I don't recall if this is in the no merit report filed by his appellate attorney in the State Court of Appeals or whether it was in the district court's opinion, but Mr. West did not even tell his attorney, Margaret Vins, the name of Damian Robinson until I believe it was September 26th of 2006. So we're talking about a supposedly important witness who was not even mentioned to defense counsel until after her representation in the case had been ongoing for approximately 11 months. She had been representing Mr. Robinson back in October of 2005, and yet Ms. Vins knew nothing of the name of Damian Robinson until nearly 11 months later.
So all of that may be true. I think one of the troubling things about this case, and it may be that there are reasons to set it aside, maybe not, is the state court's comment that it was inconceivable that had Mr. Robinson been present and provided an alibi, that the jury would have found him to be credible. Now, we don't usually do that, and actually the state will frequently say, you know, yes, witness X was a many-time felon and drug dealer and all this and all that, but it's up to the jury to decide whether to believe witness X or not. And prejudging whether Mr. Robinson might or might not have come across as credible to a jury, it doesn't sit well. So if that statement can be regarded as something we don't have to endorse or whatever, I mean, I find it troublesome.
I don't find it as troublesome because I think you should be looking at the entirety of the record when you've got a situation like this where Mr. West made his motions to dismiss based on the alleged violation of his right to a speedy trial before the trial ever began. He was really asking for dismissal, claiming 3.5 months after the complaint was filed that his right had already been violated. And yet he never renewed that motion at the conclusion of his case when he was convicted.
Of course, it's a pro se motion. Suppose the state court, when in October of 2005 he asserts his right, the state court said, fine, you know, your trial date is set for, you know, December 15th. I mean, nobody would have worried about it then, right?
Nobody would have worried about
speedy trial. I mean, he asserts his right to speedy trial. The court gives him a speedy trial.
And the fact is that he didn't ever come forward, though, with this whole idea that his, in terms of prejudice, that his rights were somehow violated by the absence of Damian Robinson. I think the whole way that arose, and his own appellate attorney And the trial court as well found that his claims were very suspicious because of the timing in which this came about. And if you look at the trial court record, which I think the court should in evaluating prejudice, you have testimony, not just by these witnesses who Mr. Hicks has castigated as being, you know, multiply convicted witnesses, but you also have testimony from a witness named Heather Rohde, who was the sister of this victim, saying that Mr. West admitted to her that he drove the victim and her brother to the county fair that day, and also testimony that he knew this victim through pictures that his girlfriend, the witness, had, and that he made some sexually charged comments about wanting to get to know her, even though she was only 14 years old. So I think all of that testimony has to be looked at in terms of saying, okay, let's just give him the benefit of the doubt and say, yes, Damian Robinson would have testified and said that you two were at a casino. I don't think the court needs to wear blinders and say, well, what about the fact that you still have Mr. West's own admission to his former girlfriend that he drove the victim to the county fair that day, and then you take that in conjunction with the fact that the victim and three other witnesses all testified that he was there outside the car in which the sexual intercourse was found to have occurred. And weighed against this, you've got supposedly Damian Robinson saying that they were at a casino at the time. I think that that can be and should be factored into the prejudice inquiry. And as two final points, the other interests that are submerged in the prejudice inquiry are the freedom from oppressive pretrial incarceration. And here, Mr. West had his parole revoked based on the same underlying conduct as formed the basis for this charge. So he was already confined, I think, in the Racine Correctional Institution or some other correctional facility at the time he awaited trial in this case. So you really don't have much of that at all, as you would in some other cases. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that the time here, 14 months, is not the kind of time between charging and trial that causes one to think that this is really an extraordinary amount of time. I mean, in Barker versus Wingo, where the court found no violation of the right to a speedy trial, you had a five-year gap between the filing of charges and the actual trial, and 4 years of that five-year gap was laid right at the doorstep of the state of Kentucky, and yet there was no speedy trial violation found by the United States Supreme Court. So I think when you apply the rule that the more general a constitutional rule is, the more leeway a state court has in reaching an outcome in a given case, when you take that principle and combine it with the principle that the right to a speedy trial is unlike most constitutional rights because it is so hard to provide hard and fast rules for its application, it is amorphous. I think we have to come down on the side of finding that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision in this case was reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time? You have 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's make three quick points. First of all, in response to my colleague's point about Barker v. Wingo and the length of delay, it's a four-factor test, and so there are many other factors that go into it. So, for example, in Barker, quote, the prejudice was minimal, and second, there was no action for approximately 3.5 years that could be construed as an assertion of the speedy trial right. So I think that you can't just obviously look at the length of delay. Second, to your point, Judge Wood, about the prejudice, it's interesting that the state now brings up Heather Rhodes' testimony. Neither the Wisconsin State Court of Appeals nor the district court ever mentioned one word about this testimony, and there's a good reason for that, because it's not inconsistent that Mr. West would have driven the alleged victim and her brother to the fair and then, after that, gone to the casino with Mr. Robinson. In fact, the times, as set forth in the brief, the times for that are very consistent, and there's nothing inconsistent about the two of those happening. And I would also note that the state's closing argument during the trial stressed that everyone here is telling you that he was there, and no one's telling you that he wasn't there. And that's exactly the point that the alibi witness, Mr. Robinson, would have made. And the last point I'd very quickly want to make is that while it is true that the Barker v. Wingo test is general, the Panetti and Miller L. v. Dretke cases from the Supreme Court make clear that just because it's a general test does not mean that there's not a case for habeas. And the multiple failures by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals make this case not simply an incorrect determination, but an unreasonable determination. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. You were appointed to take this case?
Yes, sir.
You have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to the state as well.